one of the most well-known and best-loved and one of my favorite comedians of all time was a man who created some very unusual characters as part of his comedy skits years ago. Those of you who are old enough to remember may remember Freddie the Freeloader or Gertrude and Heathcliff, the geese that always carried on some kind of conversation about something or other. Characters that were made famous by Red Skelton, who entertained millions and made millions of people laugh for many, many years. But for a period of time, while he was laughing on the outside, Red Skelton was crying on the inside. Because if you know the story or the account of his family, his son, Richie, who he always mentioned in his closing comments in most of his routines, his son, Richie, had leukemia. And they knew that he had just a short time to live. And so Red Skelton and his wife were determined to show him as much of the world and as much of life as possible in the short time that they had him. And they took him to Disneyland, took him to Europe, and to see all the sights of Europe and the Eiffel Tower and London Bridge and everything else and other things all around the world to cram in as much as life, as much of life as possible into a short time. If you knew, if we knew our future, if each of us knew our future specifically, how long we had to live, when we would die, and how we would die. If we knew when Christ would return, how would we change our lives? Or would we? What might we begin to do knowing the time that we had, knowing that there are things we all want to change, or do differently, knowing the time of Christ's return or how much life we had left? What would we begin to do now that we know we want to change anyway? Give me a couple of examples that struck me through the years in God's church and ministry. A 74-year-old retired man that one of our ministers visited a few years ago, the previous Olympics, not past Olympics, but during the previous Olympics, and in visiting him, just making small talk, and asked him if he had been watching any of the Olympics. What the man said I thought was quite interesting. He said, "No, I don't know how much time I have left for prayer and Bible study, so I have to do as much as I can." He didn't know how long he was going to live, and so this was his approach to life at that point in his life. Another one, this is an elderly lady who was spending a lot of hours every day studying her Bible, going through the old Bible study course, that old 58-lesson Bible study course from years back, was spending a lot of time doing that and a lot of time praying. And some of her family members who were in the church and some of her friends in the church said she ought to ease up a little bit, you know, be a little more balanced, that she was just spending so much time doing those things. And her answer was also interesting. She said, "My eyes are getting weaker, and I don't know how much longer I will be able to see well enough to read and to study God's Word." And so she was cramming as much into the time that she had when she still had her sight to do that. It was just the way she was thinking about things at that time. What if you knew specifically your future? What if any of us knew specifically our future? Or what if we knew exactly when Christ was returning, especially if it was going to be in our lifetime, and we knew when that was going to be? When we think about our lives, how much do you want to change? How much, when you look at yourself, when I look at myself, we think, you know, this is an area I still need to grow in. This is an area I want to change, things I want to change about my life. If we had that knowledge about our future or about Christ's return, how would that stir us? How much would it stir us? Would we start changing some of those things in our lives real fast or begin really going to work on those things? Humans aren't very good at predicting the future. I'll give you a couple of examples. Of course, Christ said we would not be able to know our future as far as specifics of this life or when he was going to return. People have tried. It's interesting to me. How many people have tried to calculate, you know, the time of Christ's return, the year of Christ's return, the date of Christ's return? And, you know, that's fine if they, you know, they find things in prophecy and find things in the scripture that gives them a clue, ideas in history, and people come up with different dates and different theories. But one thing I've wondered about, and I really can't say that I've seen this as a common thread, that somebody who has done that and settled on a date, okay, I know it's going to be 2017, or it's going to be 2012, December 31st, or whatever. One thing that doesn't seem to have happened is that it's just kind of fired them up and stirred them up to make dramatic changes in their lives. You would think that if you knew the date and you were convinced of the date when Christ was returning and you knew what it was, where is the, you know, becoming more fervent, more on fire about growing, changing? They seem to be more fervent about calculating the date and getting the date right. And that seems to be the thing that, you know, fires them up, that aspect of prophecy. You know, where is the being fired up for growing? We don't tell the future very well. Again, I'll give you a couple of examples from history. Here's a quote, Dr. Alfred Val Poe, 1839. He said, "The abolishment of pain in surgery is an illusion. It is absurd to go on seeking it today. Knife and pain are two words in surgery that must forever be associated in the consciousness of the patient." Just think if it were that way, those of you who have had surgery. There was a time when that was the way it was, and this man could never foresee it could be different. Or how about this one? Admiral William Lay to President Truman in 1945, talking about the atomic bomb. He said, "That is the biggest fool thing we have ever done. That bomb will never go off, and I speak as an expert in explosives." And of course, he didn't quite get that one right either, did he? Or this one, written by a man named Simon Newcomb. He was an astronomer, and he wrote this in 1903. Now, think about that date when you hear the quote. He said, "The demonstration that no possible combination of known substances, known forms of machinery, and known forms of force can be united in any practical machine by which man shall fly long distances through the air seems to this writer as complete as it is possible to be. That nobody would ever fly." You know, and he wrote that in 1903. And of course, later that year, the Wright brothers did fly. Or this one. "I have never heard of anything, and I cannot conceive of anything more ridiculous, more absurd, more affrontive to all sober judgment than the cry that we are profiting by the acquisition of New Mexico and California. I hold that they are not worth a dollar." Well, maybe today, California especially, may not be, you know, but this was said by Daniel Webster in a speech in 1948. The auto industry, Business Week, 1958, with over 50 foreign cars already on sale here in the U.S., the Japanese auto industry isn't likely to carve out a big slice of the U.S. market. Could he have been more wrong? And one more. "My figures coincide," this is from a man named Henry Adams, wrote this in 1903. He said, "My figures coincide in fixing 1950 as the year when the world must go to smash and complete collapse." He said it would all come crashing down around us in 1950. And, of course, he wasn't right. We're still around waiting for the end of this age. Jesus Christ tells us that no one can foretell our future, your future, my future, as far as in this life and what's going to happen specifically or when he's going to return. Let's look at Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24, as we again think about the meaning of this Feast of Trumpets and the understanding that God has given us about the significance of this day in prophecy. Matthew chapter 24, and here in verse 32. "Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things," the things that have been described earlier in this chapter, earlier in the prophecy here, "when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors. Surely I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But of that hour, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. All in the context of the end of the age, the return of Jesus Christ, events leading up to that, Christ said, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Many have tried. Many have tried to predict the future and Christ's return and have come up with dates and a variety of dates. But again, where is the corresponding dramatic change in their life if they knew and were convinced that those dates were correct? Notice what Christ also said about the attitudes existent around the time of his second coming. In verse 37, he said, but as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. What were the days of Noah like? Well, let's read on. Verse 38. Here it's described simply by saying, for as in the days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. People were going about their normal routines just like today. They were eating, drinking, working, going to school, marrying, etc. Just like today. Although it does tell us in Genesis 6 that the thoughts and intents of the heart of so many was only evil all the time. That became normal as well, along with the normal routines of life. Verse 39, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. What was their shock like? You know, it's hard to imagine what the shock must have been like as the rain fell, you know, like it is now, but a whole lot harder. It's good to see rain. You know, come, we do need it. It is refreshing. But as the rain fell then and continued to fall and kept coming down, and not only that, the ground opened up, and water came from above, and water came from below. It's hard to imagine the shock among people who could have known, those that Noah had a period of time, apparently 120 years or so, during which time history seems to record, he traveled, he taught, he tried to warn. People could have known, but instead some of them drowned, probably clawing at the sides of the ark, or swept off the top of a mountain watching their children or wife first being swept away and then they themselves being swept away. If they had just known, if only they had known, they had an opportunity. It's interesting that when you think about it, we are among those who do know, aren't we? We are among those to whom God has revealed truth, and we have to ask ourselves, and we do ask ourselves, you know, how well are we living as one who knows? How are we doing? How well are we living as one who knows this truth of God? Let's read on in verse 40 and 41. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. There are a number of lessons you can draw from that. One that strikes me is that here there are some side by side, those who know side by side with those who don't know. Side by side, living together, working together, knowing one another, those who know and those who don't know, living life, one ready, certainly having the opportunity to be ready for these events, and one not ready for what? Not ready for the return of Christ, not ready for his own death or her own death. One ready and one not ready. Verse 42, watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. We're told to watch because we don't know the hour. We know that he is. I'd like to read a quote to you. This was written on September 6th, 1941, by a journalist named Clark Beach. Again, the date, September 6th, 1941. He wrote this, a Japanese attack on Hawaii is regarded as the most unlikely thing in the world, with one chance in a million of being successful. Besides having more powerful defenses than any other post under the American flag, Hawaii is protected by distance. Most unlikely thing in the world. And of course, the next day, we know that Pearl Harbor and Hawaii was attacked. And it was a successful attack. There are a number of books written about the subject that simply point out that the ball was dropped in many cases as far as watching, staying on the alert, heeding the warning signs. They simply did not. Verse 43, "But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into." It just makes sense. If a person has knowledge of this kind, he does something with it. "Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." We know not when. We don't know exactly when Jesus Christ is coming, but we know that he is coming. That's guaranteed. We have no doubt about that. We know that he is coming, and we're told to make ourselves ready day by day with God's help, day after day, living day by day. Then Christ, you know, unless we do, Christ may come when we really aren't ready, when we do not know. But we're told to be ready and work day by day. I've wondered, and you probably have too, how many who have read and studied, for example, you know, read and studied the Bible, read and studied, you know, church literature for years and years. People have done that for many years. And many who were in the church and aren't at this time, or children of church members who have read and studied for many years, who no longer attend. I wonder if the thought goes through their minds sometimes. I don't know this because they've heard so much. They've heard sermons, you know, about Feast of Trumpets, about prophecy. They've heard these things. And I have to wonder sometimes if they think, well, you know, there's no famine yet. There's no rabid dogs roaming the streets yet. There aren't thousands of bodies in the streets yet, which would be, I mean, those things would be obvious signs to anybody that something's wrong, you know, if those kind of things were happening. But people who have heard these things and they don't, you know, see those things happening yet, you know, what are they looking for, waiting for, watching? Are they watching? Do they really believe? I don't know. I think it was interesting, what, 11 years ago now, right after 9/11, that I know at that time I was pastoring in Milwaukee and Oshkosh, and that Sabbath in Milwaukee, we had people show up at church that I hadn't seen in many years. You know, that they came that Sabbath and they asked questions. Is this the beginning of the time of tribulation? Is this the beginning of this, that? People that hadn't seen in many years, people I haven't seen since, you know, that time. But they showed up that day. It was interesting that that sparked those kind of thoughts. Let's read verse 45. "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods." The one so doing, trying to live a Christian life day in, day out, year after year. He's been living for many years as if Christ is going to return the next day. And by that, I mean, he gets up every morning and he spends some time in prayer and he spends some time reading his Bible. And he has just lived that way for year after year after year, as though Christ is returning the next day. And it has never changed, never varied from that. Verse 48, "But if the evil servant says in his heart, 'My master is delaying his coming.'" Now, why would somebody say that? Why would somebody who knows the truth of God, who knows, you know, the prophecy, who understands where God is taking us, what he's doing, why would somebody allow that to grow in his mind? "My Lord delays his coming." Wouldn't that be a dangerous frame of mind to fall into? Well, you know, it's a long time off. It's a long way off. Have you ever, you know, thought that way? I think we probably all have at times. Well, there's lots of time. You know, we don't know when Christ is returning, but we're watching the signs, and certainly, you know, we've got another 10 years, 25 years, or 50 years. We don't know. But the frame of mind, "My Lord delays his coming," is a dangerous one to fall into. If the servant says, "My master is delaying his coming," begins to beat his fellow servants. That's an interesting statement. fellow servants, others who know, you know, the truth of God, who know God's way, and begin to, you know, not love them, not care for them, not to have the same respect, regard, maybe as they had at one time, and to eat and drink with the drunkards. In other words, he begins to drift. They drift this way or they drift that way. There's a drift that begins to take place. The master of the servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him and at an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Sad commentary. It's a good reminder for us because it reminds us of what value will it be to be able to say to Jesus Christ, well, see what I used to do? See what I was doing? See what how I did study the Bible and see how I used to pray? See how I used to fast and see how I used to do this? You know, of what value will it be to be able to say, well, see what I used to do? Very little value. In John 4, and this is why Christ says, blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing. That his master will find him doing. Day after day, week after week, year after year, living a life that is trying to please God. John chapter 4, verse 7. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, give me a drink. He asked for water, for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Then the woman of Samaria said to him, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Jesus answered and said to her, if you knew, that's really what he titled the sermon, if only you knew. If only you knew. The woman, Christ said to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. Give me water. And he said, if you knew. Think about that. If she did know. If she knew that he was the Son of God and what he could do for her. If she knew. Christ said she would be asking him for living water, if only she knew. What if you had that chance and you knew that it was the Son of God? Or there were, you know, a crowd of people and they all knew that he was the Son of God. They'd be standing in line waiting to push the button on the drinking fountain to get him a drink of water. If they all knew. Christ said, if they only knew, people would be lining up to try to give him water. How many times in our lives would we have done something differently? If only we knew. If only we had known. How many times would we have done something different? I look back sometimes in the years, my earlier years in the church, and I look at some of the things we did, you know, in our zeal, and I think I must have been crazy. You know, on a winter day, you know, blizzard on the way, but there's a basketball tournament in Wisconsin Dells, and we live in Milwaukee. And so services are over, it's time to head to the Dells in this blizzard. And we did, and made it. I think we made God's angels work overtime. I remember one Saturday night, we were driving from Milwaukee to the Dells. I had an old 1966 Oldsmobile Cutlass, and all of a sudden I had no headlights, no dashboard lights, couldn't see anything. And the snow, it was just a heavy blizzard, big flakes coming down, wind blowing, and I was in complete darkness. And right then, there was an exit. And I, you know, I drove down the exit, and there was a gas station right there at the bottom of the exit. I pulled in, and I suspected it may have been a fuse or fuses, and sure enough, that's what it was. He had exactly what I needed, and in 5 minutes, I put a new fuse in and got back on the road. Instead of going home, I kept going, you know, to the Dells. And I look at some of those things like, we must have been crazy. But, you know, we were enthusiastic. We were excited. We wanted to be with people and play basketball and all those things we did. And that's just a minor example. But how many times in our lives would we have done something differently if only we had known? If I had known how bad at times some of those storms were going to be that I drove through anyway, I wouldn't have gone. We had a trip. We were in Minneapolis for Thanksgiving with my wife's family 1 year. And a storm was coming. We knew that, but we thought, well, we'll be ahead of it because it's coming from the west. We'll get ahead of it. We got out on the interstate and it was horrible. The 6-hour drive took us 9.5 hours that day to get home, and people sliding off the freeway. And if only we had known, we would have just stayed, you know, and waited it out a day. If only we had known, we would have done things differently in, you know, in other areas of life as well. At any time in our life, we don't know, but at any time in our life, we could be driving home, you know, safety conscious, as diligent about it as we can possibly be, and some drunk, you know, crosses the center line and hits us head on and our life ends. I don't want to be morbid about those things, but can we afford to say, my Lord delays his coming? That's really the point of it. Can we afford to say, my Lord delays his coming? We know. We're among those who do know. We can't say, oh, if only I had known. Because we know. We know Jesus Christ is coming back to this earth. We know there will be a resurrection of the dead. We know that each of us will stand before Jesus Christ and give account for our lives individually. And at that point, we have no one else to lean on but to stand before Christ and to give account for our lives. Let's turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Notice beginning here in verse 1. First Thessalonians 5, verse 1. Concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, Paul said, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. It is going to sneak up on people. It will come suddenly in many ways and surprise many. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. It's a good thing, I believe, my opinion is that it's a good thing for every Christian to believe that Jesus Christ's coming will take place in his lifetime. I think it's a good thing for us to believe that Christ is going to return in our lifetime, rather than to be totally unsuspecting or unprepared, but to believe that Christ is returning in our lifetime. I think there's a spur that gives us, a momentum, a vision, an enthusiasm about growing, about overcoming thinking and believing that Christ is going to return in our lifetime. It may be in this age. We don't know just how soon. But I think it's good to be thinking that way. Verse 4, but you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day, in capital letters, the day of Christ's return, should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons and daughters of light and of the day. We are not of the night nor of the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch. We're told, let us watch and to be sober or self-controlled, the word literally means. Let us watch and be sober and not asleep spiritually, for those who sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet the hope of salvation. We who know are not in darkness. Can we afford to say, my Lord delays his coming, or ever live as though God is delaying the end of the age and the return of Christ? In Psalm chapter 90, there's a sobering reminder here about life, about human life and human lifespan. And here in a congregation where 50% are over 60 and 35% are over 70, you know, in this congregation, we think about those things. I know it's on your mind. It's on my mind. You know, my 64th birthday last June, and, you know, a lot more of my life is behind me than ahead of me. You know, that's not a morbid thought. That's just the fact, you know, of life. It's the way life is. And in Psalm 90, we find some good reminders, I think, about life and the future and how to think. We're told in verse 10, the days of our lives are 70 years. And if by reason of strength they are 80, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. We're gone, you know, physically. We're allotted 70 years. Some by strength of life reach 80 years. My father-in-law, my wife's dad, reached 95 years before he died. He had 95 years on the earth. My father didn't reach his 70. He didn't get his 70 years. He had plans, he had goals, he had ambitions, but he died at age 60. He was going to retire in 2 years and had things he wanted to do, but at age 60, he had a sudden heart attack and died. He didn't think he was going to die at age 60, but he did. Some people, some young people can say, well, I'm only 21, or I'm only 30, or I'm only 35. I've got lots of time. Well, I hope you do, but we can't be assured of that, can we? Perhaps, perhaps not. The Bible describes man in a number of places as like the grass of the field, you know, here today and gone tomorrow. Verse 11 and 12. Who knows the power of your God's anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. It's an important scripture, I think, to teach us to number our days, whatever age we are, to teach us to number our days so that we can gain wisdom and have a heart of wisdom. There was a king of France. Mr. Doolin talking about kings earlier in his sermonette. King Louis XI of France was a devout believer in astrology. And he had often astrologers advising him and around his court. And he was very impressed with one particular astrologer who correctly predicted that a lady of his court would die in 8 days. And when that came to pass, he was just very impressed with all of that. But he began to have a little bit of fear of this prophet because he thought, well, this guy is so good and he's so accurate at this. This, you know, his power is going to increase. And King Louis XI decided to dispose of him, you know, to kill him. And so what he did, he summoned this astrologer to his apartments. But he had told his servants ahead of time that on a signal from the king, they were to throw this guy out the window, you know, down below into the courtyard and, you know, to kill him. And so the king said to him, you claim to understand astrology and to know the fate of others, the king said to him. So tell me at once what your fate will be and how long you have to live, he asked this astrologer. The astrologer said, I shall die just 3 days before your majesty. I will die just 3 days before your majesty. When he said that, the king, who was quite shaken, canceled his plans. Did not kill the astrologer. You know, he was numbering his days. If I kill this man, maybe it will come to pass. So it says, verse 12, a very wise statement. Teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Whatever age we are, young person, middle-aged, senior citizen, we all want to have a heart of wisdom, to gain a heart of wisdom. So it's a prayer, you know, pray and ask God to teach us to be mindful of our days. Not that we fear and, you know, we just mourn the passing of time, but we do take account and number our days because we have only so much time in which to gain a heart of wisdom. In Ephesians chapter 5, again, we're reminded about the days in which we're living, the age in which we live. And here in Ephesians chapter 5, and beginning in verse 15, Ephesians 5, verse 15, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Redeeming the time, using our time wisely, because we see evil around us. You know, there are several lessons in that. If we don't use our time wisely, you know, we perhaps may be more easily influenced by the evil around us and just have a more of a challenge resisting those things if we're just wasting time. But also we see that the age in which we live, the days of history and what's happening seem to be getting more and more evil and more anger being stirred up. And Satan really does seem to be stirring those things up. And the day just seemed to be getting worse and worse and not better and better. And so we're reminded to redeem the time so that evil can't so easily creep, into our lives, and we become less alert, less watchful, less strong spiritually. Redeem the time. Then James 4, verse 13. Again, one of those sobering reminders. We don't, it's not one that we want to turn to a lot. We don't, again, need to get morbid and depressed dwelling on this, but it's here, and it's a good instruction for us. James 4, verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It's one of those questions that we're not to get morbid and depressed and discouraged, just dwell on that, but we're asked, what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. It's precious. We love life. We love all the things that life can bring. And as we get older, we look back and we think fondly about this experience and that experience, and we enjoy doing those things. We look forward to the future, but there's more past than there is future, and so we have a lot more to think about the past, because we've had so many experiences of things. And we realize that life is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. We don't know for sure if there will be a tomorrow for us, no matter how old we are. Again, it's not something to get morbid and depressed and discouraged about and dwell on, but we ought to consider it at times. And we read on in verse 15, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance, and human beings can be so arrogant, can't we? All of us have, have had our chance at arrogance, and we still will at times, and in the world around us, we see so much arrogance. You boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. To him who knows. If only you knew. If only we knew. Well, we do. In God's church, there's a great deal that God has given to us. What if, in some way, we could know that Jesus Christ was going to return to this earth in the year 2013. About a year from now, in the year 2013. How would we respond to that? What would our reaction be? For some of us, it might be the way we used to do in college, and that is to cram for finals. We start cramming. We can't really cram spiritually, though, can we? It's kind of hard to cram in character. It has to do with things we are to be doing always, a way of living, a way of life, a steady progress in our lives. In Hebrews chapter 11, we call it the faith chapter. And notice the account in verse 8 through about 10, Hebrews 11. Verse 8 through 10, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He waited. And then notice verse 13. These all, and the whole list of those that precede the account of Abraham in verse 13, others before, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. They saw these promises, they had been given these promises, and having seen them afar off. And think about that statement, having seen them afar off. How far off was this promise for Noah? How far off was this promise for Abraham? How far off was this promise for Isaac? a lot further off than, you know, than it is for us by several thousand years. Promise was a long way off. But it says they were persuaded. How persuaded were they? Just how persuaded were they? Verse 14. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. Those who confess they were strangers and pilgrims, those who saw the promise far off, declare plainly that they seek a homeland. How did they do that? How did they declare plainly that they seek a homeland? Well, I wasn't there to hear, you know, what they may have said, but from what I can read in the scriptures, one way they declared plainly what they were seeking was by their lifestyle, by how they lived their lives. They clearly were seeking God's kingdom by how they lived and their relationship with God declared that they were seeking a homeland. And it's the same for God's people. When I think of all the people in God's church I've known through the years, and those who just have continued faithful, steady, year after year, year after year, seeking God's truth, growing in understanding, growing in love, growing in wisdom, obedient to God. You know, by your lives, you are declaring that you seek this homeland, the kingdom of God, that this day represents as beginning to come to this earth. In 2 Peter chapter 3, and here in verse 10, 2 Peter 3 and verse 10. Again, a reminder about here the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. This eventually is going to happen. All, you know, the works on this earth are going to be consumed and burned up, and you know, God's kingdom will reign in the universe. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat? It's a question. What kind of person, you know, are we to be? Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, what things? What things are you looking forward to? What things are we looking forward to as we read these scriptures and remind us and are reminded what we're to be like? We're looking forward to Christ's return. There's a lot of heartache and suffering and trial and tribulation, you know, that leads up to that. And a time when we have to have a great deal of faith in God, but we are looking forward to these things. Christ's return, the kingdom of God beginning to be established on the earth, God's government, man's government destroyed, God's government established. An end to every kind of hatred, every kind of war, murder, destruction, all those things that are going to end. You think about it, we have never lived in a world where no one was against someone else. We've never lived in a world since there have been human beings on the earth where no one was against someone else. Muslims against, you know, Christians, Arabs against Jews, and going back further than that, Catholics and Protestants, and, you know, just pick, you know, any group. Have we ever lived in a world where no one was against anyone else? It's never been that way. And that's one of those things we look forward to. We're like in a family, we taught our children, look, when you're in the house and when you're part of our family, and family, we're for one another. We help one another. And this is what God is teaching us. And that's the kind of world that's going to be coming. So we're told in verse 14, therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, all these things that the return of Christ and the coming of the kingdom of God mean, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot, and blameless, because we know. We're not among those who don't know. We know that Christ is coming back and is going to return, maybe in our lifetime, maybe not. I ask facetiously, in a sense, wouldn't you just hate to go out into the world on a day, on a bad day, and you walk out of your house, you know, kick the dog on the way out, ignore your wife and kids, you know, on the way out because you're angry about something, and you leave the house and go out into the world on a bad day, and that just happens to be the day that Christ returns. You know. And again, I know that God judges our lifetime. You know, he doesn't, you know, it's not just one day that God is judging. God judges our lifetime, our faithfulness, our character, and growing over a period of a lifetime, not just one day. But the point is to realize, I think, and to remind us that, you know, to remind us of the importance of using every day, of redeeming the time, of using every day to, with God's help, make ourselves a little more ready for the future, a little more prepared for the future, with God's help, with God's Spirit. To use each day to be a little more ready and prepared. There is an organization that only lasted 18 months, but of all the organizations that you've ever heard of, that in a sense was the epitome of being prepared, this one was. It no longer exists because of technology. After 18 months of its existence, it went out of existence. But while it was doing what it was doing, it did it very well. And so when it comes to being on the alert and ready at any moment to do the job, it's really hard to beat the Pony Express. Ever heard of the Pony Express? Remember the Pony Express? It was the historically famous mail service that ran between St. Joseph, Missouri, all the way out to California. And it depended on constant movement and readiness to be successful. Relay stations on this route were established about every 10 to 15 miles. And a rider would, as he approached one of these relay stations, when he got within shouting range, would start shouting and would start yelling so that those who were at the station knew he was coming. And he would shout, giving the station master not a lot of time, but just, you know, shouting distance time to have the next rider and horse ready to take over from the one coming in. So he had to be prepared. He had to be alert. He had to be watching because he didn't have much time when a rider was coming in, just short notice. Even when a rider came to the station and he was going to spend the night there, another rider was already mounted, waiting, and ready to grab the bundle of packages or letters and ready to take off and on to the next station. And the completion of the transcontinental telegraph system ultimately made the Pony Express obsolete after just 18 months. That's all the time it really existed, about 18 months. But what an example of being watchful, of being alert, being ready, you know, and on a short notice. The Pony Express was certainly an example of that. So we're told, we're reminded in Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21, it will sound familiar to and similar to what we read in Matthew 24. Here in Luke 21, beginning in verse 29. Then he spoke to them a parable. Again, the parable of the fig tree. Luke 21, verse 29. He spoke to them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they are already budding, you see and know for yourself that summer is now near. We see leaves falling and the days getting cooler. We know summer is almost at an end. We're getting ready for the fall feasts, fall festivals, as this day is. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. I think, you know, for most in God's church, carousing, you know, we're too old to carouse, most of us. You know, we're not into carousing. Drunkenness, you know, there are some in God's church that fight that battle and, you know, and avoid drinking. But the one that all of us struggle with is cares of this life. And that day come upon you unexpectedly, for it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. church members and non-church members alike. That day is going to come. And so in light of that, the exhortation in verse 36, watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Watch, pray, that we can be counted worthy to escape with God's help and God's protection, because we will stand before God and Jesus Christ, and our lives will be judged. If we knew our future, if we knew when Jesus Christ was going to return, or we knew just how long that we were going to live, what about the things that we still want to change in our lives and things we know we need to and want to change? What would we change? And if we knew, what would we do different right away if we knew? 11 years ago, after 9/11 happened, I received an email from a young adult, a young lady in God's church. It was an email that was quite interesting to me. And I wanted to read some excerpts to you from what she wrote after that day. I think it's dated September 13th, 2001. So 2 days after 9/11 happened, this is what she wrote to me in an email. She said, and again, I'll break into the thoughts here and there. I keep asking myself and wondering, what does all this mean? And my imagination has been running wild with possibilities. And I think for many in the church that was going on. She writes, everyone keeps saying we're the strongest nation, and they messed with the wrong country. We have to teach them a lesson. Everyone assumes that we will always be victorious and remain the strongest nation in the world. But I know that one of these days we won't be strong enough. If this is the beginning of a chain of events, one day the impact of one of the links will be too great. The impact on one of the links will be too great. Someday we won't recover, and we won't be able to teach them a lesson, and we will fall as a nation. Maybe not this time or this incident, but sometime. Is this the beginning? She asked. She said, right now we have a lot of support from many nations. I see many nations coming together in support. Someday the nations will be coming together to fight against us. Is this a stepping stone to show nations how to practice unity? Another step to the United States of Europe, or more importantly, I see nations coming together someday to fight Christ when he returns in all his glory. I'm sure similar events will occur when he returns. And of course, he will be seen as the enemy, the one at fault, and everyone will fight against him. She says, the fact that the fall holy day season is here also speaks novels. Of course, these are thoughts that automatically race through my mind when something like this occurs. I think of the scriptures in Matthew. And then she quotes from Matthew 24, wars and rumors of wars, nation rising against nation, beginning of sorrows, deliver you up to be afflicted and shall kill you. Many false prophets shall rise. The love of many shall wax cold, but he that endures to the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world, and then the end shall come. It's funny, your concluding note. It's funny. This past Sabbath, just before 9/11 happened, which was on a Tuesday, it's funny, this past Sabbath, I was reading Revelation, just wondering when and how will it begin. And now, my awareness is heightened, watching, waiting. She says, my awareness is heightened, watching, waiting. I think 9/11, did that for a lot of people. But then it wears off, then you forget. In this particular case, I know the individual, and she is diligently watching and waiting, and has not let it just wear off. If we knew, if only we knew, would it be wise, if we know that there are things we want to change in our lives, isn't it wise to maybe start some of that change now? Not cramming. We don't know when Christ is going to return, but living every day God's way to the best of our ability. Living every day, spending some time with God, some time with his word, and living every day to the very best of our ability and with God's help. If you really knew, what would you do?